Rappin' with Reef Bum is sponsored by Polo Reef, Champion Lighting and Supply, and GHL.
Hey, what's happening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Rappin' with Reef Bum. I'm your host, Keith Berkelhammer. So on today's live stream, I welcome Salem Clemens. What's going on there, Salem?
Nothing much. Living life. Ready to graduate.
Living the dream there,
Great to be on here. Yeah, I guess so. I'm on Reef Bum. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm living the dream. Long overdue, man. Long overdue. Very psyched to have you on, Salem. So, Salem has been in the hobby for a decade now, huh?
Yeah, I look like I'm 15, but I'm about to turn 23. I've been doing it since I was 12, so
wow.
Right about a decade.
Yeah, wow. No, that's amazing. He's been in the industry for the last 5 years, worked in the industry, and has worked in numerous fish stores and now farms coral, phytoplankton, and copepods on his own. Salem is in his senior year pursuing a degree in molecular biology and biotechnology with a minor in chemistry. That's a mouthful.
That's a lot.
He is researching coral pathogens, zooanthellae. Yeah, that's a tongue twister. Holobiont. How do you pronounce that?
Holobiont.
Holobiont associated signal transduction pathways. Dude, I'm having trouble even pronouncing this stuff. I don't know how you can study all that stuff. That's got to be quite the complex. Study material there, but he wants to pursue a doctorate and would like to go into conservation work eventually. So before we start chatting with Salem, I want to take care of some business and thank the sponsors of this show. My sponsors are really important because they make this show possible with their support, and that means a lot since I want to continue bringing on awesome guests to help foster a learning environment on the show. Polar Reef is one sponsor. Make sure to check out Polar Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday after an unexpected aquarium leak in the Polo Lab. Oof. Check out what drastic measures the team had to take as a bonus treat. Be on the lookout for a video drop tomorrow highlighting a special guest podcast. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polo Reef for video drop notifications. Another sponsor, Champion Lighting and Supply. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Oh, and Todd and the Champion Lighting crew will be at Reefapalooza Orlando this weekend, so be sure to stop by the booth and say hello. And finally, my third sponsor is GHL. Personally, I'm all in on GHL products. I've had a lot of success using their dosers, Profilux 4 controllers, the Mitra's lights, the cage director, the whole nine yards. They produce high-quality German engineering products. For more information or to purchase their stuff, you can visit aquariumcomputer.com/USA. I also sell their products on reefbum.com. All right, with that out of the way, Salem, man, how did all this begin for you in terms of this passion for corals and reef keeping?
Well, I suppose, like most things, started when I was a child. So my parents, you know, like my mom would take me out to like the shopping mall or something, and we'd always go to the aquarium quite often. So like my favorite movie was like Finding Nemo. So from like a young age, aquarium stuff or like fish or the ocean kind of became this happy place for me. When I was about 10... we went to Florida one year, Sanibel Island on vacation, and my parents came across this thing called the Sea School. They said, "Do you want to go to this?" And I went to it, and it was ran by a marine biologist, and he took us out in the field, and like he was collecting samples on like sand dollars and starfish, and we got to collect data with them, and he just explained the whole like ecology to us and how this everything was interconnected, and it really cemented the idea that like, wow, I think I really want to do this. I'd always liked science, but being there and doing the science when I was that young age and a sponge really solidified it. So we got back home. I did a ton of chores and we picked up a little 10-gallon all-in-one on Craigslist that was just like neglected. And I read a bunch of books. So I grew up in Tonganoxie, Kansas. I did not have the internet. So we went to like Barnes and Noble and got these reef keeping books. So I was reading about like the Berlin method and all these things. And I tried basically just taught myself stuff, and then I've been doing it ever since. And got into college and I decided I'm going to go and pursue, you know, molecular biology, the biotechnology stuff. And I go to a small university in Kansas, and typically to graduate, you have to do a research project. You will often do another professor's research project to get graduate kind of experience, basically. And I said, well, what if I do my own? And I pitched it to one of the professors, and they said, okay, what do you want to look at? And I had been farming coral, and obviously brown jelly is a big deal. And I had a bunch of torches I had spent way too much money on, holy grails and everything, all got wiped out, lost a ton of money. And I was like, you know, financially irresponsible getting them in the first place as a college student. And I'm like, okay, well, maybe I have some of the skills to look at this problem and figure out what's going on. And I've been doing that for 3 years now.
In terms of just kind of digging into the brown jelly disease and potential cures?
Yeah, it kind of started out as brown jelly. And after, you know, having my head go against the wall for various reasons, I determined that looking in particular at one disease state was kind of the wrong way to go about things. So my research over the last several years has evolved into looking from like a bird's eye view at holistic mechanisms that cause disease states in corals. So it's not just jelly now. It's RTN, it's STN, it's zoopox. Really most symptomatic things we see in the hobby, I'm kind of looking at, is there a universal pathway that can cause that event? And I think yes.
Well, we definitely want to dig into that tonight, but let me ask you a couple more questions in terms of your you said you're 23 years old, you're a young guy, and you've gotten involved in the hobby quite young. What do you think is how can the hobby attract more Salems? You know, I mean, obviously the young hobbyist is the future of reef keeping, and you know, I don't know what the average age is, but you don't see a lot of young people, you know, as passionate as you are about it. How do you think we can, as a hobby in general, kind of attract more young people?
I really think that having like an education type component could be good. So like for me, you know, and also a lot of other younger people that I have met, like Sean Ono is a great example. He's a new writer for Reef Builders, really intelligent guy, my age as well. And he grew up, you know, in California, like around tidal pools and stuff. So at least everyone I've met, it all begins with a fascination or intrigue with the ocean at a young age. So, you know, I think like Walt Whitman High School is an example. They have like tanks in classrooms, and they have students do like a science fair-esque thing where they do research. Like someone was feeding like binnipeds to coral and track growth over a year of time and stuff. So I think, you know, if big corporations or like media companies that are in the industry really want to encourage people to get in, probably sponsoring more classroom type projects would be good. Donating tanks to schools, having educational things. I think having a community presence would be good too. So there's a lot of antagonism in the hobby. People are very reluctant to have conversations. And I think that people can be very harsh on beginners, and that can also push people away. So more welcoming, more education, and just sharing your passion about it instead of biting people's heads off.
Do you think there's, you know, so obviously, you know, social media is a big part of how people take in information, especially, you know, younger people. What's your impression in terms of the current landscape and YouTube channels for reef keepers?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think there's some really good resources out there. I am someone who is relatively skeptical. And, you know, most big channels, you know, especially if it's like a non-consumer platform, they typically have an incentive to push different products. So I think that there are a lot of innate biases with many platforms out there. And then there's also kind of this like subset of people who just are like, here's my tank, and they want to show it off, and it's not educational at all. So I think it's kind of going through the weeds and sorting out people who are just sharing their passion, people who might be biased, and finding those needles in the haystack that are really good educational platforms that are not biased. And I think there are a lot of those out there.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes you just kind of have to dig around a little bit, and you know, I guess stuff will kind of pop up into the feed, so it all depends in terms of what is trending in terms of the content that's out there. What about, you know, you mentioned, Holy Grail Torch and spending a lot of money and all that stuff. This is not a cheap hobby, right? And when you're young, you don't have a lot of disposable income to spend on hobbies. How do you think people, you know, at that age with not as much, you know, disposable income, how can they kind of overcome that in reef keeping? What were some of the things that you've done to try to acquire more corals?
Yeah, so I definitely have been budget in a lot of ways. So not bought like the fanciest equipment and cut corners where I could. That's one thing. Another thing is, you know, I got decent enough at growing coral to where I could trade for other pieces I wanted or sell them to shops and things. And over time, I was able to slowly then and go and invest in a higher end piece. And then it kind of builds up slowly over time. I think that also, you know, buying from like local hobbyists or trading is a very good option. A lot of the frag swaps, you can get good deals. But the most important, I mean, I had to like really work. Like I worked like I got like a second job over the summer because I'm like, I want to buy a lot of coral this summer. So I was financially irresponsible about it. I'm a lot better about spending money on coral now. And I just kind of buy the pieces that I like. But hard work and being smart and not rushing into it and taking your time and, you know, doing things slowly, I think, is important.
You know, I think coral swapping is a lost art, and I think more people should definitely be kind of in tune with that part of the hobby in terms of trading, right? You know, that doesn't cost any money.
Yeah, it really helps build community, too. So, like, a lot of my closest people in the Kansas City community, I met them, like, through the Facebook group, and I'm like, who has stuff to trade? And everyone kind of gets excited about it because you don't have to spend money. And they, if you're growing coral well enough, you typically have an extra frag or two of whatever you have. So, yeah, trading, I think, is definitely something that I don't see as often. Like, during COVID, it was huge. Yeah. That kind of led to, like, a resurgence in my local community, at least.
Yeah. So how did you get involved with Reef Builders? Did they find you, or did you kind of, like, float something out there to them?
Yeah, Jeremy Gay, who's like our head writer, like he's a workhorse, does so much writing. He randomly messaged me one day. I was posting, I had this like big rant actually about cryptic sumps. I'm like, these things are so great. And was just kind of posting what I wanted to on Facebook. And he's like, hey, do you want to write for Reef Builders? And I was like, yeah, that'd be great. That sounds awesome. And then, yeah, I've been there ever since. So
yeah, so you're like doing a lot of stuff for Reef Builders. You're doing live streams yourself. You're writing. What else? I mean, are those the two main things that you're doing? Yeah, obviously you're another video content.
Yeah, so they're trying to push me more into video content because I've had more free time. So I got to go to Reef Stock. I went to St. Louis and hung out with Remy. So in the future, after I graduate, I'll probably be doing a lot more content, product reviews, things like that. I'm getting a nice camera here, some kind of shorts and things. But yeah, the main thing I'm doing is articles and then the live stream. And then I'll be on Reef Therapy every once in a while as well. So
yeah, I mean, before the show we were talking, you were telling me, I don't know if you want to share this. Well, I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but you're thinking about taking a year off in between getting that doctorate. And
I think
perhaps
so.
More time for Reef Builders.
Yeah, I think I'm kind of schooled out right now. It's been a lot. It's been a lot of hard work, and I'm at a pretty happy place in life to where, you know, from my perspective, I'm really living the dream in a lot of ways. I really enjoy working for Reef Builders. I enjoy getting to do the research and growing coral. So I think it sounds nice to take a break and spend time with my friends and family, and I'll probably write a lot more for Reef Builders in that time.
Cool. And what would the what's the goal in terms of the doctorate if you pursue it?
Yeah, so I mean, right now I'm looking at, you know, kind of applied microbiology programs. That's definitely the angle I like. So Eli and Andrew have kind of geared me towards Oregon State right now. They've got a very good lab there for coral microbiology. Talked with Kevin Erickson, you know, from Ames, and he's at James Cook University down in Australia at Reef Stock, and he floated the idea of potentially going there. And that's an option. So I'm kind of up in the air right now looking at several different programs. And, you know, I'll have a year to kind of think about things and apply. So
cool. Well, it's you're in a great position. It's great to be young. And I totally agree with you that a year off in between is probably a dynamite idea.
Yeah, I think so, too.
You mentioned cryptic sump. You also sent me some photos of your tanks and your setup. You want to dive into that, Salem, in terms of, let me show the shot of all your tanks there. You've got, so how many tanks you have in at your house there?
So I've got like seven. That shot of the three, those are actually all plumbed together as one system. Those are each like a sub-satellite system. So the low boy sprung a leak. So it's
the low boy. I had a low boy that sprung a leak too, and I got rid of like a brand new low boy because I was like, you know what? That's all I need is like to see one low boy spring a leak. And yeah, I was like, that's not for me. I know somebody that bought a low boy. Can't remember who it was. I think basically they before they even set it up, re-siliconed it. But did you get rid of it? Or you re-siliconed it.
I'm probably gonna get rid of it. Like I got it used from a buddy, and it was like 5 years old already. Yeah. So I might get like a 60 breeder there, maybe. That's like, and then I'll re-silicone it beforehand. But yeah, I need to plumb something new in there. I'll move the T5s down because they're like mounted way too high. But yeah, it's like a 90 gallon is like the 6 foot. And then it's got halides, T5s, reef brights on it. And then I've got the cryptic sump, which is a 50 gallon drum, goes into a 75 gallon primary sump. Then the other little like 2x2 cube is one of like the deep blue 30s, I think. Uh-huh. So if I put like a 60 gallon there, I think it's like 250, 300 gallons roughly in volume. And then I've got, yeah, 8-bolt Dimble T5 on the low boy section. And then Radeon G4 Pro and Reef Brights and T5s on the last section. So
give us an idea in terms of why you chose that lighting. I mean, so the one lighting that I'm showing here, the fixture, you mentioned it's halides, T5s, and are those Reef Bright XHOs? Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yep. XHOs. Yeah.
So metal halide, that's part of the mix, huh?
That's part of the mix, yeah. So, I mean, I went about this by looking kind of it both anecdotally and scientifically. So, like, a lot of the new papers talk about the sunblock theory of pigment development in corals. So if corals are exposed to, like, the more broad of a wavelength of light they're exposed to, the more fluorescent pigments or, like, you know, visible pigments that will develop to basically act as sunblock to block that spectrum. So in my mind, if I've got like a Radeon or an AI Prime that's got like a 400 nanometers, you know, peak, but no infrared, no UVA, no UVB, no 600 nanometer peak, you're probably missing out like on a lot of potential coloration there. And, you know, anecdotally in my system, switching from LEDs to the, you know, power hungry monster I have now, I've definitely noticed things color up a lot better. So the T5 bulbs, I've got a UVA, UVB reptile bulb, and then an infrared bulb they use for like flowering weed and stuff I found online. So and then it's like 15K halides. So altogether, if you kind of superimpose the spectral charts, it's like everything equivalent par, full spectrum.
So what kind of par are you getting out of that combo fixture?
It's like 500 at some points. So. Yeah. But I'll just run the halides, you know, only for like 2 hours a day. And then like the DL, I kind of do things by DLI is kind of how I'm doing it by. So there'll be a peak in par, but the overall average par of the day is a lot lower because the reef brights will be on most of the time.
And talk to us about corals you have in your tanks. I'm showing a couple, you sent me a couple of pictures, I guess, of your favorites, some Zoas and an Acan.
Yeah, mostly just like LPS and softies, you know. I've not really, after deciding to be financially responsible, I have not dug into sticks because, you know, I'm kind of hands off. I'm very busy with school, my research work. So I, you know, have things as automated as I can get them. Zoas will be fine. LPS will be fine. And then I just have always liked kind of weird softies. So I've got like a bunch of odd leathers, like the pulsing simularia and stuff. At this point, I'm like, I'm just going to buy stuff I like, but I'm starting to like sticks, which is dangerous.
It is. But you can get some, you know, cheap stuff. I think like a lot of the old school classics that might have been pricey a number of years ago, you can get fairly cheap. Yeah, you know, not crazy amount of money, but you know, like I've talked about a lot. The Milka Stylo is like just an awesome coral that's just gorgeous. That is really pretty cheap and. There's stuff out there. But yeah, you could also kind of like really get into the whole thing and the name game and stuff like that and just go bonkers. But that's not necessary.
I mean, yeah, I want some speciosas. That's my problem. I like the look of them.
Yeah.
So, but I got a free Walt Disney. Chris Kapp from Aquatic Art gave me one of reef stock. I brought it home. I was getting good growth. It started growing pretty fast. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do sticks. And then in one day, my AC broke in my apartment and it was like 85 outside. And then my main bulkhead on the 6-foot tank sprung a leak. So I had to drain the tank halfway and fix that for like 5 hours. And then also I had a seat. I mean, yeah, this it died. The stick died. So I had some bad luck.
Well, yeah, that's too bad. I mean, it's, and you know, tenuous is not the hardiest of acros out there. It can be a little temperamental in terms of what I've found. But yeah, you know, I think there's always more behind that. So
I'll blame that on bad luck. I think I was doing well with it before like a confluence of Murphy's Law happens. So I'll get some more.
Yeah. So obviously you don't have a chiller because the temperature kind of crapped out on you and all that stuff. But you don't. I mean, these days I don't think chillers are totally necessary. But I guess in the Kansas area it does get pretty freaking hot there in the summertime, huh?
Yeah, it's really like weird because in the summertime it'll be like 90 degree humidity, 110 degrees, and then this winter it was -30 with wind chill, like. It was colder than Antarctica on Google weather. It was like, okay. So it's dealing with both extremes is the problem. But I probably will invest in a chiller after that.
Yeah. I mean, how do you manage in terms of the bringing in fresh air from the outside when it's -30 degrees outside? You know, do you have a lot of CO2 that builds up inside, you know, where the tanks are at? How do you get fresh air in during the wintertime?
Yeah, CO2 has been an issue because I'm in the basement level of an apartment complex, so the amount of pooling is just insane. Plus that, so I've tried not to rely on external air because I don't really have a good way to do it. Like, I'll open the windows most days, but I had a CO2 scrubber I was actually changing out, so I usually have that plumbed in, and then I'll just dose. Like, I mean, I dose so much calc, so that's about all I can do, but... In my old apartment, I didn't have as much of a problem, and I was able to keep it, like, you know, Meckley level. But now it's, like, you know, 8 to 8.2 I'm happy with because I know I'm fighting an uphill battle. So,
that's good
enough.
What I mean, so what do you like to keep your key parameters at, you know? So pH is 8 to 8.2. What about the other stuff?
So, I mean, my alk will usually be around 10, and then, like, calcium is, like, 450 to 500. The one thing that I do like to keep high is magnesium, so, like, above 1550 I try to keep it.
Oh, really?
And my rationale with that is just, like, the way that magnesium works chemically is it kind of is, like, a regulatory chemical for every redox reaction. So, like, mentally I'm like, okay, if I have this at a higher level, then it's, like, more of a buffer for, like, everything in the system. And that's like head logic. I have no data to support that, but I don't know. It's worked.
It's been working for you.
It looks nice. Stuff looks nice. So
yeah. Cool. All right. So let's dig into some of the research that you've been doing. So you've been doing a lot of research on coral disease, correct? Talk to us specifically about what you've been focusing on with the coral disease research.
Yeah. So like I mentioned earlier, I'm doing kind of looking at the big picture. So if you're familiar with aquabiomics, all of that is kind of this omics technology. So
explain that. What's omics?
Yeah. So, you know, omics is kind of like a Greek suffix. It's like all, like a big picture is kind of the best way to think about it. So there's lots of different omics technologies. There's, you know, the genomic stuff like metagenomics, which is what the aquabiomics stuff is. Something I'm working with is metabolomics, which is looking at all of the chemicals produced by a system. There's proteomics. You can see all the proteins that are happening. And basically, it's just the cutting edge science is occurring is all this omics stuff. So there's new technology that's been developed for the last just 10 years that allows us to see kind of the big picture of biological and chemical systems. And I am applying that technology to coral disease. So that's kind of where the cutting edge is moving beyond traditional molecular techniques and using new cutting edge techniques to get a systemic view of health. So what I am looking at is the intersection between changes in the microbiome and changes in the chemical concentration that are produced in the coral's mucus. So typically, you will see shifts in the mucus, and then that will correlate to shifts in the microbial profiles and families. And you can deduce all of that back to how the external environment changes. So it's really looking at coral as this biochemical system with their environment, and you get a broad picture of what happens when you have jelly or you have RTN or you have a zoa randomly melt. And writ large, it's kind of the same process that that happens with all of these different disease states.
So what have you learned? What kind of insights have you garnered through this research at this point in your studies?
So there's a lot I can't talk about yet because, you know, intellectual property, getting things published and things. Yeah. But I can kind of speak vaguely about, you know, if you want, I can kind of explain the general pathway for how, at least at this time, I understand, you know, coral disease to happen. And it's a lot, but it's the biggest thing is that we have to kind of move beyond the one pathogen, one disease model. So when we think about human health, like if I got COVID, it's the SARS-CoV-2 virus that caused me to have that disease state. And often people look at coral disease and they say, ah, Vibrio caused this. And it's not that simple. Corals are primordial animals that have this holobiont, this associated microbial community that they completely depend on. And that microbial community is basically governed by ecological principles. So natural selection, competition, and availability of resources, meaning it's not static. It is completely fluid and changes with the environment. So instead of saying there are always this species associated with the coral, good or bad, it's more so what roles those species play. So corals will always have someone that is fixing available nitrogen for them. They'll always have something that's, you know, producing some types of regulatory compounds to keep pathogens at bay. They'll have guys that are involved with nutrient cycling. And that could be a number of different species that fill that role, depending on the external environment. There are certain families that have been identified that are really good, and their job is basically to keep everyone else in check. So they will down-regulate the growth of everyone else who's just trying to race for the resources the coral is producing, because the coral is kind of this beacon of nutrition in a very nutrient-less, like a nutrient, you know, scarce world of a reef. Reefs are real, have very, very like low nutrient concentrations in the water, but coral mucus is like the holy grail of things to eat. It's got fatty acids of all types. It's got amino acids. It's high in protein content. So bacteria naturally want to eat it and exponentially reproduce. These good bacteria basically tell them, no, calm down. And they can control given gene expression of different bacterial species. So if the coral needs more iron, they can say, all of you, go take up iron from the environment. And then coral will eat that iron-heavy bacteria. It basically gut loads them. So these kind of, you know, conductors of the symphony, so to speak, are very important. And what happens is they die. So every pathogenic event is always going to be correlated with an abiotic stress event or a biotic stress event. So examples of that are the temperature can increase in the aquarium or the ocean. You can have a pH swing, or you can have like a fish come and eat a piece of the coral and there's physical tissue damage. What happens is instead of the coral directing all of its, you know, potential and energy towards regular metabolic function, it then diverts a disproportionate amount of energy towards an immune response. So it says, okay, we've got a problem here. We need to like keep ourselves alive. And the general immune response that corals have is the production of reactive oxygen species. So hydrogen peroxide corals will produce. And basically these free radicals go into the area and they indiscriminately kill like everything. You know, they have basic, you know, kind of leukocytes, so things that are similar to white blood cells that can eat bad guys too. But they really rely just on reactive oxygen species, their mucus, and the good bacteria that defend themselves against bacteria. So because they are not producing the normal, you know, metabolic functions that they would be, that leads to a change in the chemicals that make up the mucus. So usually the mucus has certain sugars, certain amino acids, and certain fatty acids that are relatively conserved concentration. The good bacteria have evolved over millions of years to selectively eat that plate of food that's been made for them. So whenever the coral goes through a stress event, the available food changes. And there was a new paper I was actually reading today, and they've now found evidence that, you know, when the sugars that are produced in coral mucus change, many pathogenic bacteria are better adapted at eating those different sugars. So then they simply begin to outcompete the good bacteria. And on top of that, zooxanthellae will produce specific sulfur-based chemical compounds that are chemoattractants. So Vibrio and other coral pathogens have evolved to sniff out these compounds. So the good guys usually eat them. At this point, the good guys are slowly dying off and being beaten back by all those guys they're keeping at bay. So there's good guys that switch to being bad. It's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that are endemic and localized to the coral. And then because they're trying to fight for their lives, they're not eating all of these chemicals produced by the zooxanthellae. And then that recruits the really bad guys. So the coral goes through a stress response and simultaneously deals with an internal and external pathogenic event at the same time. So people say, okay, it's Vibrio causing this. No, it's a completely new disease model that's making us rethink even human health. So it goes from symbiosis to dysbiosis. It's a dysbiotic state, a holobiont to what's called a pathobiont. So a pathological microbiome. It's not just one bad guy, but it's this consortium of events that occurs from a biochemical perspective that causes the coral to just turn into jelly, you know, wither away. And
lot to unpack there, Salem.
Yeah, that's the TLDR. That is the kind of my understanding and at least a lot of the literature's understanding of what happens with coral.
All right, a couple of questions and comments, perhaps from the viewers. Talk to us about the difference between gram-positive and gram-negative bacteria. Gram-positive bacteria. I'll let you get into that. What? Why is that something that we should potentially try to understand? And I guess the reason why I'm mentioning gram-positive versus gram-negative is antibiotics. So let's kind of like get into that discussion in terms of when is it appropriate to use antibiotics and why does that make a difference in terms of the gram-positive and the gram-negative bacteria?
Yeah, so, gram-negative, gram-positive is a differentiation that is made from a laboratory technique called gram staining. So bacterial cell walls, one of the primary components is a chemical called peptidoglycan. And this guy figured out that you can actually use external stains to stain the peptidoglycan in cell walls. Now, there is a structural difference between what we know as gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria, to where gram-negative bacteria will basically have a secondary external membrane with a chemical called LPS or lipopolysaccharides on it. Gram-positive bacteria have a very high concentration of exposed peptidoglycan. So using this technique, you basically apply a stain and this thing that decolorizes it and gets rid of it, and then you apply a counter stain. This is a very simplistic explanation of it, but you end up with two bacteria that will be a different color, and that tells you the structure of the cell wall. So the way that antibiotics work is they have to get inside of the cell typically. So if we're looking at something like Cipro or oxalic acid, these are quinolone-based antibiotics. Cipro is a fluoroquinolone, so they've added a fluorine to it. So oxalic acid is primarily just a gram-negative targeting antibiotic. It has the ability to get through that very thin peptidoglycan layer and penetrate into the cell and do what it does, right? It inhibits like topoisomerase 4 or something, right?
And that's significant because those are pathogenic type of bacteria in terms of gram negative. Is that true?
So
that not, there's more to it than that.
So it's kind of the same thing with how I mentioned how we're applying, humans are very good at thinking in absolutes and duality of black and white, right? So we're thinking, if one pathogen, one disease, this is all good, this is all bad. There are many very beneficial gram-negative organisms. All of our all of the nitrifying bacteria are gram-negative. Pelagiobacter aceae, which is one of the most abundant picoplankton and coral nutrition sources in the world, are gram-negative bacteria. Vibrio, Archobacter, known pathogens, can also be gram-negative bacteria. But even in the Vibrio family, there are many good, purely symbiotic Vibrios. Some of the most important, basically, immunological support that coral have are Vibrios that produce localized antibiotics to ward off purely pathogenic strains. So in my mind, we're trying to take this concept that's on the edge of human comprehension that we are only just now beginning to understand with new cutting-edge technology and put it in this box of good versus bad when it is a much more complicated situation than that. Now, many of known coral pathogens are gram-negative. There's gram-positive as well. there's some coral pathogens that don't even fit into the box of gram negative or gram positive. So example, like aqua rickettsia, that's a common thing that people deal with. It's associated with like stony coral tissue loss disease and things like that. It's not gram negative or gram positive. It defies the way that we categorize it. Now, you know, if we're looking to eliminate or downregulate the levels of known pathogens, like let's say we have a tank with just a ton of Vibrio in it. You know, that's probably not super good. And it's more, probability-wise, it's likely most of those are primary or opportunistic pathogens. If you have the diagnosis, if you have a baseline that's been established by aquabiomics, you could be a little bit more comfortable using an antibiotic in that instance. But I think prophylactically, very bad idea. It's going to build resistance. We're targeting the, we don't even know what we're targeting, right? It can be, it's this consortium that causes the issue. So to say it's this and we're going to treat it prophylactically does not make sense. And we're also killing a lot of the good guys. And as I mentioned, those good guys are the only thing that keeps the coral together. If they die off, that is the linchpin that causes them to go into a disease
state. Are you talking about the use of Cipro and oxalic acid, that there is collateral damage when you're using those types of antibiotics? That it's not all like just targeting the bad guys, that some of the good guys are getting knocked off as well?
I certainly think so, yeah. So, I mean, now, if you're doing like the KFC dip outside of the tank, certainly. You're applying three different antibiotics and peroxide and iodine. You're nuking everything. And how the only way the coral recovers, they can reuptake bacteria from their environment. But if your microbiome is already messed up in the environment, this is going to be off from like a worse start at that point. Or you have not applied the correct time, contact time or dosage of that bacteria. And now you have a resistant strain, which is even harder to deal with. Now, if you look at like Eli's recommendations, like Arcobacter, known to be associated with the pathobiome, can be an exclusive coral pathogen. He has found evidence that applying Cipro at a relatively low dosage can, you know, selectively inhibit that. So having the correct dosage and contact time to target a known family with diagnosis is much, much more different than saying I've got a lot of Vibrio and I'm going to throw Cipro in my tank. Because as I said, there's some good Vibrio. Without a species level breakdown, which you can request from aquabiomics, but you have to sort through all of that data, you're not going to know if you're killing good or bad. So I think there's certainly collateral damage. And the worst thing about that is there's no way to replace it. We have live rock and live sand, but there is not a single, you know, product on the market from the back perspective. I mean, there's the hydrospace, right? It's coral associated, but that's one microbe that does one function. There is, you know, like Telegram has sent in aquabiomics data for BioDigest now, and it has a lot of the good guys, but also there's a lot of unknowns. We don't know if it comes with known pathogens. We have not seen a species level breakdown. We don't know the manufacturing process to where if there's consistency with that community. So if you nuke it, it's gone, and you're probably going to be worse off.
Polo1126, thank you so much for that super chat. Thanks for another great guest. Love the content and discussion Salem is bringing it to the hobby. For sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was going to be a question of mine, is bacteria dosing. And, you know, does that help on a daily basis to an established reef tank to try to, you know, multiply or grow the population of the good guys versus the bad guys? Because I think, what, every reef tank does have some pathogenic bacteria in it, right? It's just a matter of certain conditions opening the door for them to multiply, correct?
Yeah, so I mean, there's that difference between pure pathogens and opportunism. And that's the thing, is that internal event are guys who are good. Almost all of the corals holobiont that are typically good can shift to being bad based on external swings and gene expression that's virulent. So there is no escape from having a pathogenic event, even if you theoretically wipe out every pure pathogen, because the good guys can always become bad, which is scary. Now, in terms of dosing bacteria, we need to apply the same logic we do to dosing any chemical in our tank to the biological side. We have a way to quantify it now. You shouldn't dose what you're not testing for. And you should also ask yourself, what am I adding to my tank? A lot of the problem and a lot of the pushback with a lot of the trace products, right, is that we don't know the exact concentration of what traces are there. So now we have moonshiners. We have like the Captivate method, you know, the Triton method, to where you have each individual trace element isolated and you can control the dosing through regular ICP testing. We do not have the product side of that for the microbial world. A, there's no company being transparent about what strains are in their products. B, we have tested most of the products now, and there are no saltwater or coral-associated strains that are really on the market. Mm. It's all human gut microbiota, which have been repurposed. You've been lied to, and they have sold it to you as coral probiotics.
Why not? Why have we not seen any coral, microbiome type of products that you can? I mean, why is that? Is it difficult to supply on a large scale? Is it just the human type of bacteria easier for companies, cheaper for companies to produce and sell?
I think there's two angles to it. The first, I think, is ignorance. And the second, I think, is ease of profitability. So I think that those two combined, I mean, this is all very cutting edge science. Like, there's papers that come out every day. 5 years ago, this was not even a concept, right? People did not consider coral health. Now, adding terrestrial strains like Bacillus subtilis to a tank, these are known to anaerobically consume nitrates. So all these clean products probably do work for public aquaria. They do what's desired. The question now is, if I am adding a preponderance or an excess of a terrestrial strain to my system, will that have a long-term impact on the coral's microbiome? I think potentially, right? If you have someone that takes up the same resources from the water column that many of these good guys utilize, there is inherent competition there. So I think that these companies were likely ignorant about very new science. And also, it is extremely cheap to buy any of these strains. They are widely used in laboratories as model species. They have been cultivated for the human health industry. So I think it came down to an R&D session. They had money. They saw the potential for a product line. They Googled probiotic and they said, this must apply writ large. I don't think it's anything malicious, I've seen they're lying to you. I think that they're not being transparent, but that's probably not from a point of like trying to completely screw you over. But I think that there should be awareness that all of the claims on these things, aren't really coral associated. And there should be some skepticism now that we have a way to generate data as a hobbyist. You can go and buy any product and send in an aquabiomic sample and see what's in it. Right. There is no man behind the curtain anymore. So,
right. So in your view, dosing bacteria to try to promote coral health is probably it's tough to tell in terms of whether that's beneficial or not.
I mean, they're not coral associated bacteria, plain and simple. They're terrestrial strains, which means the coral likely does not uptake them into the holobiont and they are direct competition. Can they help maybe potentially outcompete pathogens in the water column? Yeah, but they're equally likely to outcompete any good guys because they're taking in and the bad. So, maybe they do have coral associated strains. There are many that claim they do, but I've not seen the data or the transparency behind that. So what I've tried to call on them to do is like, okay, if you got it, put your money where your mouth is, because now you're going to sell more than ever because people are aware of this. So maybe there are products out there, and I'm not trying to bash every product, but I think most of them are terrestrial strains, and it's simply the wrong bacteria for the job. If our concern is coral health, we know there are conserved coral-associated bacteria that are relatively universal that do this key job of regulating the holobiont, regulating gene expression, eating those infochemicals that recruit pathogens. And so far, no one has done the work to put them in a bottle.
So, we hear this term a lot about, probiotics. People are using probiotics to try to promote coral health. What can we do as reef keepers to try to insulate our corals from getting, disease, from those pathogens overtaking us? If you were advising somebody in terms of what to add to their tank to try to probiotically, aid corals, what would you say would be the best way to go?
So the number one thing is, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Stability, the age-old additive, every single pathway begins with instability. It could be abiotic. It's a swing. And that is what causes this whole cascade. So number one, not chasing specific numbers, so to speak. Like if you're beginning out, mastering the basics, keeping your tank as stable as possible is number one. Second, I think nutrition is a very good component. So I do like the hydrospace stuff. It is known to be coral associated. It just does not do everything. It provides nutrition. You know, there's a lot of other benefits that, you know, Rotosudomonas has. So that's a good thing, like any of the PNSB stuff. I think the addition of things such as phyto, pods, rotifers, trying to capture, plus the hydrospace stuff, all of that combined, you kind of capture all trophic levels of nutrition. So if the coral is more healthier from a nutritional standpoint, that means it's more likely to have better, basically peak metabolic function, producing the right sugars in the mucus, preventing pathogen recruitment. I also think there's practical things to where you can expand your microbial community in a more balanced way, so cryptic sumps. I think there's a lot of potential for remote deep sand beds. I think that we could explore adding a very diverse anaerobic population through a sand bed that's deep, and not like 6 inches, but like you get the same drum that I have and you fill that up with sand. You've got 3 feet of sand you never disturb and you let methane be produced. That's like maybe something to try. So those are kind of like, I don't think that there's this silver bullet of something to add. I think it comes from a holistic approach to coral care, and we simply have to rethink these things and view it as a biochemical system. I think trace supplementation is good. I think there's skepticism there with some of the elements, though, right? I mean, it could be absorption versus consumption. There's some of these things that are being pushed to where it's like, there's no peer-reviewed data that shows that corals uptake this element. There is data showing that rocks can absorb them, for instance, copper.
Yeah.
So there's skepticism there too, but the major traces, there's, I mean, like iodine, manganese, iron, like, I mean, there's a ton of data behind those. Like, yes, dose them all day. Use ICP. That's a great way to boost things too.
You know, I have a cryptic sump on one of my systems and I love it. You know, it's kind of like a set it and forget it type of thing. And I've got about 100 pounds of live rock in it. And it's a repository for just sponges, microorganisms, you know, microfauna and filter feeders. I mean, it's great. And I think the more you know, live rock and stuff that you could have in a system, and the more surface area for bacteria to colonize, hopefully mostly the good guy bacteria, the better.
And I mean, yeah, I mean, look at like your video on it inspired me to plummet into my new system. I was like, wow, that's a good idea. That makes a lot of sense. But look at the aquabiomics data you have. You see a clear community shift because you created that space for things to live. Like, I mean, it's clear cut at that point in my mind. I mean, something else, though, is I really think there's importance to full spectrum lighting. So having UVA, UVB, and infrared, many of these corals have evolved for millions of years being exposed to that full spectrum of lighting, especially for example, like acros or higher light stuff. And I think that has a direct impact on the microbial community. There's new papers coming out that shows that excess UVA and UVB exposure causes some symbiotic marine fungus that are associated with the corals to upregulate the expression of these chemicals called mycosporin-like amino acids. So these are like sunblock that they produce. So if you have a higher intensity of that UV, these fungal populations will increase in concentration to protect the coral, but they also do a lot of other stuff. They metabolize those infochemicals that prevent pathogens. They produce many metabolites that are responsible for the coral getting nutrients. And also, they break down many complex molecules in the water and directly feed the coral-associated bacteria. It's like they generate a carbon source and have localized carbon sourcing for like the coral bacteria. So, and that all comes from the wavelength of light we provide our coral. So, I mean, I think a lot of the companies out there just are ignorant about new data.
Do you think that the tendency for a lot of folks out there that run very blue lights can that potentially be contributing to this pathogenic bacteria thing that's going on, where people are noticing brown jelly disease or RTN, STN with acros? Can lighting be a potential reason why that stuff is happening more so now than in the past, where there wasn't as much blue lit tanks?
So I think what you said is important, a reason, right? So, you know, I don't think it's a root cause. I don't think there is a root cause to any of this, rather just a variety of proximate causes. So I think that from a coral health perspective, at least for higher light corals, naturally, they benefit from those wavelengths. And there's the data with the fungi. Now, maybe super deep water stuff, like if you've got like Australophilia wilsoni from Western Australia that's collected at like 100 meters, maybe it doesn't need those wavelengths of light, but a lot of the corals do. But I think it's holistically how we have changed keeping coral in the hobby and all the things we've done. So we've gone towards a lot of UV sterilization, which is known to kill all of the picoplankton in the water column, which outcompetes the bad guys and feeds the coral. We now use dry rock and bottled bacteria that's adding one or two strains of bacteria instead of getting that diversity of good guys from the ocean. We have full blue lighting to where, and we just don't really have, like, I think we probably keep our tanks a little bit too clean. So this consortment of factors has led to poorer coral health. And also it's created this kind of biological wasteland that is not anywhere near diverse in the good ways the tanks used to be.
Chris Carney is asking, do you think it's possible to keep a too stable aquarium creating fragile corals?
That's a good question. So I've read some papers, and there are some benefits to having a natural pH swing, you know, with the day and nighttime, because corals have evolved to have that natural swing to an extent. So I think so, right? Like flatlining stuff for a really long period of time. It's like let's say you've got like a system that just dialed in for 5 years. There's going to be a process of artificial selection there. It would be like the reverse of what aquaculture typically does. So we take a wild coral and we basically expose it to the instability of our systems for 10 years. And now we have like Oregon tort, which is like impossible to kill. And is like a homestead that's been adapted to that instability. It would be the inverse. You like have them unlearn and it's used to only 8.4 pH. If you sell a frag of that, it's getting nuked, man. So yeah, there's probably a healthy middle ground between having a relatively short or condensed like range of like where swings are at.
What about fragging corals? I mean, does that, you know, help potentially build up some resistance in terms of, kind of toughening up a coral by fragging it? Is that something where, might come into play for, certain SPS not being as prone to RTN, STN if they're constantly being fragged? Not constantly, but let's say, every now and then being fragged. I'm just kind of wondering, in terms of toughening up their, the coral itself, putting it through some stress.
Yeah. So that's where another one of those misnomers we as humans comes in, right? So corals do not have an adaptive immune response, like at all. Like they don't have immunological memory. They don't have antibodies, meaning if they encounter a pathogen, they don't remember that pathogen. Mm. They have a very simplistic rudimentary response to where they generate those reactive oxygen species. They hope the good bacteria eat them or produce an antibiotic that kills them. And they have mucus. And that's about it. And they have cilia that kind of like move them, which are kind of like a little muscle, so to speak. So the idea that we can build up resistance by exposing them to stress in some way, I think there's not from a biological or like an immune perspective, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But maybe like through the process of aquaculture long term, we can get them used to dealing with those swings to where they don't produce those infochemicals that recruit pathogens and they continue to produce the normal amount of sugars. Now, where fragging really is important is it's essentially a form of amputation, right? That's if you've got recession, all of the negative guys are at that line of recession. So if you cut, a couple inches up from that, you really increase your chances of having that saved. And also glue is like a physical boundary. It's a polymer that's really weird for bacteria to grow on because it's a surface they're not used to. So the process of fragging and gluing things is kind of, we've invented our own way to like amputate like, a wound basically. So there's that.
Mike Berry says natural varying temperature swings have been shown to increase coral hardiness. And Chris from the ACI says temp swings are huge on the natural reef. So that seems to be a part of it, right? So if you want to if you're keeping your tank, you've got your chiller, you got your heaters and all that stuff, and you want to keep it at a rock solid, like 79 degrees all the time, potentially that might be weakening the coral if you do have an event where that temperature swings outside of that very tight range.
Yeah, so like I say, I think there's a middle ground, and we also have to consider what parameter we're talking about. So temperature will naturally swing in the ocean greatly through weather events. There's even like vertical thermoclines. There's like a 3 degree temperature just as the current comes through, high and low tide. So that's something that corals are naturally exposed to. pH, on the other hand, is a lot more conserved, right? Like there's not really a lot of parts of a natural reef that are going to dip below 8.2. And for millions of years, it's been in a very defined range and only changed recently. So I think when considering acceptable swings that can optimize coral health and hardiness but not cause or set off a pathogenic event, we need to think parameter specific instead of just like writ large this percentage of swing. So things that are relatively conserved in the ocean, you know, maybe don't mess with those as much, like pH. Try to keep that stable. But temperature, you probably have some wiggle room there. And as long as it's like not prolonged, your tank is at 85, you probably are a lot safer, I would say.
In terms of ranking temperature, pH, and alkalinity, which one would you put at the top of the list in terms of being the most important to keep track of, to monitor?
I am with Chris, like, you know, high pH gang, you got to chase it. I think pH is extremely important. It, you know, it's a measure of the ion potential in the entire system. So every single chemical and biological reaction is regulated by what your pH is. It controls how fast enzymes work on the biological side. That controls how fast bacteria reproduce. I mean, it really is, I think, probably the most important parameter to chase and get down because it is just integral to everything else. And alkalinity is just a consequence or a measure of the buffering capacity of a system for pH. So, you know, it comes back to pH as well. I think there's just something to say about keeping your alkalinity stable. You know, there's like this whole weird, like, you know, carbonate bicarbonate ratio that might play into a lot of things, but it still is just typically a consequence of pH or directly the calcification process. So pH, I think, is number one. Absolutely.
I'm kind of bouncing around a little bit. Carbon dosing. Are you a fan of that?
I don't know yet.
You haven't done it?
Well, I've done it, but so we recently partnered. I got to talking, you know, with Eli and Andrew at ReefStock, meeting them, and we put our heads together and came up with an idea, which I think I'll have an article probably out tomorrow on Reef Builders about it, and I've talked about it a little bit, but we're going to have a community science project. So we are taking in people, and we're going to massively collect data and have controlled experiments where people use different carbon sources, and we'll be able to actually see if there's a significantly significant difference in the community populations that are correlated to a given carbon source. So right now we don't know what carbon source could promote the growth of which families, if any at all. It's very well known in microbiology that different bacteria have adapted to better utilize different carbon sources. And obviously in the instance of coral pathogens, many of these good guys can only selectively uptake a small number of carbon sources, while the bad guys can eat basically everything. So what we hope to find is maybe dosing this carbon source can upregulate the good guys, or maybe we'll find that they all upregulate the bad, and it's a practice that's maybe best left in the past. But hopefully by mid-July, we'll actually have data to answer that question and say, is this a way we can make the microbiome actionable and begin to change it in our tank without completely nuking everything with an antibiotic?
So without that data, without that knowledge, it's a risk, right? Because you could be loading up the bad guys.
You certainly could, and at least the existing literature says that one of the reasons the bad guys are able to compromise a coral in a pathogenic event is because they are better, they have basically the genetic capacity to metabolize different carbon and sugar sources better than the good guys. So if you've got an existing microbiome that's not too good, who knows what could be happening from that?
You know, there's a lot of food for thought here. What really kind of freaks me out a little bit is what you were talking about before about, you know, how the good guys can turn into bad guys. That's just like sinister, you know?
it's this like cannibal, it's kind of like poetic in a dark way. It's this like cannibalistic act where all the coral's friends, they see it's going down a bad path and they stab it in the back and begin to eat it. It's crazy. But that's the thing. They're like the medium guys, right? They can be good or bad depending on the environment. But there are true really good guys, and the really good guys are few and far between, but they keep everyone else in line, and they keep them on their best behavior. They're like the they're like the police, so to speak. They're busting down on the crime if the other guys are getting a little suspect.
So I got to talk to you. I got to ask you about the concoction. I know you've talked about it on Reef Therapy, and you've probably talked about it in numerous places and numerous times. But a while ago, I had Paletta on the live stream, and Mike talked about how he was experimenting with this concoction that was devised by Alan Vo, and you and Remy had Alan on Reef Therapy to talk about it. So, so for those that don't know, this is like this probiotic concoction that's used to feed corals bacteria that have been, I guess, stimulated and enhanced rather than feeding corals straight bacteria. So you're kind of like loading up the bacteria with stuff, and the stuff includes like vitamins, amino acids, enzymes, probiotics, and a carbon source. So you're kind of like getting the bacteria full of all this stuff, and then the corals are consuming the bacteria. So talk to us about that, Salem, in terms of this concoction and the risks, you know, the risks that are associated with doing that sort of thing in your reef tank.
So
there's a lot there, right? I mean,
yes, yeah, there is.
This is not a simple topic.
So let me begin by saying I've got no beef with Alan. I've been texting Alan like a regular basis. He's a great dude. His head's in the right place. I think he's doing it for the right reason. And I think his goal of trying to create a better way for coral nutrition is good. Now, where this, you know, the logical and skeptical part of me comes in is basically a lot of what I've already talked about. So number one, you know, my background is in applied microbiology. I have been working with growing bacteria. That's the majority of my research, right, is working with bacteria. And to culture bacteria, you want to be as aseptic as possible. You want to have control over what strain. You want to only move those cells. You want to make sure there's no contamination from you or from it to you, right? You can get sick. Even if it's just like a normal guy, it can become pathogenic. So I think there's two issues right at the gate before I even get into the complicated stuff. And that is the issue of the products. We don't know what bacterial strains are contained in these and if they're coral associated and would be good long term. And those are the ones that we're culturing from this because it's all the products that are contained in the foods or the bottled bacteria. Two, without, you know, really good practice, like the closest we could get to kind of like hobby level science of what this looks like is like Taras from TSA, right? Like culturing Fido. He wears the mask. He sterilizes everything. He's got alcohol like every 3 seconds, gloves. He doesn't touch it. You know, he uses basically like an autoclave or bleach and sodium thiosulfate. If we're not applying those principles and we're using this in our kitchen or we're using a microwave to sterilize the water, there's a lot of concern there. And if you have a rich media source with everything that any bacteria needs to grow, not just the ones you think you're adding, there could be human pathogens. There's a lot of problems. So like Telegram, he had a bottle of EcoBalance. He sent an aquabiomics report. There were known antibiotic resistant human pathogenic bacteria growing in that bottle of EcoBalance because they somehow got in there through contamination. Like it was one he had opened, right? It wasn't like from Dr. Tim's, but they are able to use the nutrient sources that are in that bottle to keep the Dr. Tim's EcoBalance alive. So Alan advocates for using products that are expired. We've already opened so we don't waste them. If that is true with that, who knows what we're adding and who knows what we're growing in high concentrations and who knows what we're introducing from our hands or our environment if we're not perfectly aseptic, working with a flame, with a laminar flow hood, autoclaving things. Like, you know, this is something that needs to be very controlled. Yeah, like basically, but I mean, we could be growing anything and there's no what it is. And it could be things that are dangerous to us, not even just the coral. So that's number one. Aseptic practice, very important. And it needs to be taken seriously because this can be a very serious human health risk, clearly. Two, like if you're immunocompromised, I would not do this at all. I simply wouldn't. Two is we don't know what strains we're adding. You could have known coral pathogens that happen to grow in your EcoBalance. It takes a single drop of water from your tank. You could have any of these terrestrial strains, and we don't know the long-term impact of those. So that's the other ones. You're also adding a carbon source, which I just talked about carbon dosing. You're also adding amino acids, and I've got a whole thing I can go and talk about with those. I don't add them. That's all I'll say about them. But there,
you don't add amino acids.
Nope, I don't. There's problems there too. And you know what? I guess I'll open the can of worms. And if every company gets mad at me, as I mentioned, there are sulfur-based compounds that are known infochemicals. These are produced as a byproduct of zooxanthellae going through stress, and coral pathogens have evolved to detect those. Amino acids have the chemotactic potential of like 100 times more than these sulfur-based compounds. There have been papers that have compared the movement of known coral pathogens to a mixture of amino acid source to these sulfur-based compounds, and they move more towards amino acids than any other compound we've tested.
So what you're saying is basically that amino acids could be a lightning rod for coral pathogens.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. So you're telling me, like, you know, I'm going to make my tank green. Think about how many people have anecdotally been like, yeah, a lot of my coral just got brown jelly after I dosed that. I mean, yeah, it makes sense now. That's not something I publicly said because that's a bestseller for every company out there. But I think there are amino acids that are likely selectively good that don't have that chemotactic potential, but data will need to be generated over a long period of time to determine what that is. And that's something that I would like to look at with reef builders going forward. But, you know, I avoid them at this point. You know, I'll feed phytoplankton. I'll feed
live phyto,
you know, yeah, like live phyto or pods. You can get amino acids from that in a much better, I mean, it's like a living pill, right? You gut load multiple species of phyto to some, like, you know, like apopods or something, and then you get all of that nutrition plus the nutrition of the pod itself, and it's like a localized living pill to the coral of what it needs in terms of amino acids. So that seems like a much better way to capture nutrition than adding in chemicals that have been shown through peer-reviewed data to attract coral pathogens.
You know, I think I've talked to people that say, you know, anecdotally, when they dose live phyto, that they don't notice any difference in terms of the corals. But are you saying that potentially you might not see physical differences if you're using live phyto or like live, you know, rotifers or whatever you're doing, that maybe is just kind of helping the health of the coral itself, not necessarily in a physical way that you're going to notice?
Yeah, so that's the biggest thing is I don't think it's going to be – I think, one, you have to be consistent with it, right? So adding it once a week is not going to cut it. You really want to add a high cell count daily, and you also want to have the bio load to support that because these guys will rapidly consume excess nutrients in the tank. So it's kind of like a high in, high out, and it would do the same thing that carbon dosing would, but you don't have that worry of adding – or fueling pathogens. So you could use it as a nutrient export method, which is nice.
Phyto.
But you want to add it consistently.
Phyto,
yeah, for live phyto, yeah. Yeah. So it can be that, you know, so you want to add it consistently. You want to add a blend of species. And that's not to say you need 12 species. Like Taras, I think, has a lot better idea of how to do it. And that is there are certain species that have certain benefits. So one has a higher fatty acid. You got Rhodomonas that has the carotenoids. You've got the green stuff that's a different micron size. I think also, though, having the rest of the trophic levels of nutrition. So having your zooplankton, too, through rotifers, through pods, having bacterioplankton, which the best option for that is the hydrospace stuff at this point. So there's not really like true bacterioplankton, but it would fill that micron size. So having all of those together works synergistically, and you're going to see a better impact adding them all than just adding one because they all capture a different micron size and a different part of the nutritional spectrum. With phytoplankton, you're mostly getting fatty acids. With the bacteria, you're mostly getting protein. With, you know, like zooplankton, you're kind of getting a mixture of that and also some more complex molecules. So you're not going to probably see, like, your torch become pure yellow overnight. But prolonged use of this altogether, maintaining stability, I think you'll see some benefits. And it's also likely good for coral health. Yeah.
Vinny Guarno, Vince Fins, how about feeding ammonium bicarbonate?
I like it. I like ammonia dosing. I think there's a lot of data behind dosing it instead of dosing nitrates. You know, feeds the whole nitrogen cycle. corals directly uptake ammonia as a nitrogen source instead of nitrates. There's like one paper that shows that maybe Postlepora can use like nitrates a little bit, but most of that is the holobiont or the zooxanthellae themselves consume it. And there's a lot of data that shows having a disproportionate nitrogen concentration in terms of what nitrogen source you have can kind of make the microbiome a little bit wacky. So I know a lot of people that dose nitrates and they have like cyano problems. And I was like, you know, dose ammonia, the problems will go away. But I also, you know, Andrew shared some interesting things with me. And I think he'll have more to say about it next week with some other things, which he hasn't even told me. So it might be completely evil. It might be terrible. We don't know. But maybe he can answer that a little bit more. Anecdotally, it seems to make sense to me with the data that's presented.
Yeah, I'm going to have Andy and Eli on next week. What question? Oh, back to the food question. Ryan Washington, frozen food not as good? Question mark. For example, Reef Nutrition. Yeah. What about frozen food, Salem? What are your thoughts in terms of the different stuff out there in the marketplace that we can feed our fish? And I guess so you know, corals as well. I mean, there's stuff out there for both.
So there's probably better people than me that are more educated about that particular part of the market that can speak on it. Like, you know, like Chad from Reef Nutrition, I'm sure knows a lot more about the manufacturing process, right? Like I could speculate that maybe some of the nutrients are not as high in concentration. It's also probably more convenient though. I know there's been some concerns that some frozen fish foods, like if you're using like, you know, like a lot of like tip, like you get squid and stuff that is like a lower quality that is used for commercial feeds. Like you can have associated like Vibrios and stuff that are with that. So potentially frozen food from like a sketchy source could serve as like a bacterial, vector. I don't know that though. And I also don't really like want to bash every company because it's certainly really convenient and, you know, it gets the job done. But there's probably some questions we could ask there, but I like without data, I don't really want to go and say like I at least don't know enough about the manufacturing process to speak confidently about it.
This is a completely different question for you, but I while it's you know in my head, I want to ask it to you. You're a super intelligent guy. Acro-eating flatworms. That's a coral pest that has just been you know plaguing this hobby for a very very long time. There's no real answer to it because you can't kill the eggs. You're a super intelligent guy. They're saying what is the potential solution to finally beat that pest in terms of the acro-eating flatworms? Any thoughts? Any possibility you might dig into the research on that could help us out tremendously?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Oh, so you've been thinking about it, huh?
I certainly have some ideas.
You do,
but. I do, but that'll be a later project. But I think there's certainly some angles that we could approach that with. Yeah, I will say that.
I mean, that's like you know that pest and Monty eating nudies. You know the eggs. That's the thing, right? That's the bulletproof thing that you can't get through with dips and other types of medications. But I guess if you had a laser and you lasered them, then you could take care of them that way. But.
They've got like combines that use AI now with lasers, and instead of pesticides and herbicides, they scan everything in a field and they selectively kill like insects and stuff. You could do that. Someone could make some like little robot, I guess. But there's likely some potential solutions that I've thought about.
All right, so we'll, at a later time. All right, so that's my little sidebar. Back to what we're talking about with foods. Ryan Washington, what about do-it-yourself fish food, as likely or not, in terms of good, bad? Is that something that, you know, I do a do-it-yourself fish food, coral food, where I go to the supermarket, buy a bunch of salmon, got some white meat fish, scallops, shrimp, throw in some Vitachem to help, you know, with the vitamins for the fish and all that stuff. What about that stuff? Is that okay, good idea? Not going to help that much?
I see. I think from a nutritional perspective, it's great, right? Like you're getting a really good mixture of lots of different animals that way. And you're probably capturing every single major macromolecule that these animals, you know, fish, coral, whatever, needs to thrive. I think, you know, if we're trying to push the boundaries and think, though, like, could there be a problem with this? Yeah, maybe the bacterial side, right? There could be implicit contamination on that. Like, you know, like we typically will cook human food, right? That gets rid of that. We don't eat food raw. And for that, that's because of potential bacteria that are on the food, right? So who knows what could be persisting on those sources of food from the ocean. And it could be known pathogens. Who knows? So that's the only concern that I would have with it. But I think that it's definitely cheaper than a lot of commercial options, and you're definitely nutritional benefit. So, you know, if you're, I think there's some cost-benefit analysis from the perspective of someone doing it to consider there.
Does microwaving food help make a difference before you use it? Would you have to do that every time you're feeding?
That could maybe help, right? Like, if you're going to make a bulk batch, I suppose you could maybe cook it, right? Maybe that could help. You could actually fully cook it, ensure it's not raw. That you kind of sterilize it. But then there's the question of, like, you know, are some of, like, the macromolecules converted into a form that, like, they're not able to digest? Like, so we need, like, a food scientist on for that. I don't know. There's a lot of questions there. You could maybe cook it. I certainly wouldn't, like, throw antibiotics in it to fix it. That's not the route that I would go.
So speaking of that again, some common stuff that people use in their tanks to get, you know, solve some problems, like cyano. You mentioned dosing ammonia nitrate, right, to help instead of dosing pure nitrate, potentially alleviate some cyano. What about the use of chemicals like ChemiClean to do that? Is that okay to do every once in a while? You know, but you know, I think we've seen data that shows that does impact the microbiome, and potentially you can create resistance in the tank in terms of pathogenic bacteria eventually not being impacted by that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's the same thing as any other antibiotic. Erythromycin, ChemiClean, it's an antibiotic. And I personally feel like cyano is not a big enough of an issue to have to nuke my tank and potentially take out really good coral-associated bacteria. We simply don't know the long-term effects of this. I know we can look at aquabiomics data, and I can tell you these families decrease and they're good. And, you know, that's something that I've seen conserved in a lot of samples. So I would say there's more practical effects that are not going to have that large of a systemic impact on your tank to solve cyano, like getting your nitrogen concentrations in order and the right concentration of molecules, you know, higher flow in the area. They're a biofilm. They form because of a low anoxic environment. So there's a lot of practical solutions to resolving it that I think could be better besides throwing an antibiotic in the tank. And who knows what consequences that has.
What about fluconazole for bryopsis?
So that's something I'm going to test pretty soon here because I've got some suspicions that it could be bad. So I'll have a really big article on Reef Builders out probably next week. I've been writing it for some time now, like
right,
beefy, like
I
three.
I don't want to like spill the beans then.
No, it's okay. It's not, I don't have the data yet. I'm going to do some aquabiomics test, but the idea is we've been very transfixed with bacteria for a while now, but I want to introduce the fact that there is an entire microbial world there. And one of the core microbes that are associated with corals are fungi. And fluconazole nukes fungi. Yeah. And I think there's, you know, just like the good fungi that can grow from UVA, UVB, my thought is there's likely a very profound effect on the fungal communities in our tanks. And it could be the same concept as using Cipro and things like that. Now, does it kill... works.
You cut out there for a second, Salem. Can you just repeat that last part?
Oh.
Yeah, the Wi-Fi hiccuped on you.
Yeah, so like, I mean, it did. I jinxed myself. But yeah, I mean, does it kill algae? Like, yeah, it certainly does. It certainly does the job. Fluconazole can do it. It can get rid of a lot of things that other, you know, turf algae, by process, things that are really difficult to deal with, it resolves. But the question is it affecting a part of our tanks we typically don't consider or even look at? So, and the only way you're going to get the fungal data is if you send in the 18S, like the fish pathogen tank DNA test, not the typical microbiome test from aquabiomics. So I think on that.
Oh, okay. So for the to study the impact of the fungi, you're not just using a regular microbiome test. You've got to use a tank DNA test to see how that's impacting. Do you have to do both, or just you recommend a tank DNA?
Yeah, so I mean, fluconazole is not really going to have much of, at least I don't know of an effect off the top of my head it would have on bacteria. It's more of like a, you know, antifungal, like it's designed, you know, for yeast infections is basically what it's made for. So it's an antifungal compound. So the way the aquabiomics test works is one is 16S RNA and one is 18S RNA. And those are conserved regions for how RNA, you know, is made in those cells. So it's prokaryotic versus eukaryotic. So you got bacteria where you have all eukaryotes and fungi are eukaryotic. So if you're looking at the fish pathogen test, that's eukaryotic DNA and you'll see the fungal side of that. So you'd have to send in that test to quantify that instead of the microbiome.
So digging in a little bit more, Salem, in terms of the, you know, the importance of fungi in the aquarium and why we should potentially try to understand that more, you know, I mean, that's an area that I think, you know, has not been talked about a lot.
Yeah. So, I mean, the holobiont is not just bacteria, right? It's every, I mean, there's good viruses, there's bacteriophages, there's good protozoans, so like ciliates that are beneficial in some ways. There are archaea, which are really weird. And there's good fungi. There's even some good algae that live inside of the coral skeleton. So this, the coral is really an assemblage of like all domains and walks of life in one little micro ecosystem. So, I mean, we've recently in the hobby got the idea of bacteria, but fungi perform very similar functions. There's fungal pathogens. They're very rare, but it can happen. And there's a lot of fungal good guys who are conserved and are associated with most coral species. And a lot of those fungal good guys are kind of top-down regulators as well. So with the bacteria good guys, they help influence the entire microbiome. So, for instance, they'll break down a lot of complex, like fish waste and complex molecules because they have the more sophisticated eukaryotic machinery to digest and break down those more complex chemicals. The byproducts they then produce as waste become localized food for the bacteria. So they're part of the thing that helps keep all of the bacterial population in check and in a symbiotic state instead of a dysbiotic state. A lot of the, you know, excess metabolites they produce are also, you know, localized antibiotics that can ward off and protect the coral from external pathogens. So they're really integral to nutrient cycling and immune responses and are really one of the big things that help keep the microbiome in a good shape and help stop a pathogenic event. So if we're adding fluconazole and we get rid of those too, and then we also add Cipro and we get rid of the good bacteria, I mean, our corals are kind of naked and afraid out there.
So what would you advise aquarists that are having issues with their tanks and are about to use antibiotics? What would you say would be the, you know, your advice to those people out there that kind of want to go nuclear on the tanks to solve problems? What would be your recommendations besides using antibiotics?
So don't get me wrong. I think that antibiotics can have a place, right? If you have, so for instance, I was talking to Ben Johnson, you know, from Reef Beef, and he had a client tank. They sent an aquabiomics aid on it, and 50% of the population was Vibrio. Yeah. It is the most messed up microbiome I've ever seen. It had zero good families, and half of it is known coral
Hopefully
pathogens.
Ben washed his hands before he went to the next tank.
That's what I said. I was like, man. But the thing is the tank looks great. There's no issues. So that is A, more proof for that idea that you have to have a swing to cause an issue. No matter how messed up the microbiome is, you got to have something to kickstart that event. But B, I told him, I said, okay, you've got diagnosis, so to speak, now. You should probably keep, you know, something like oxalic acid on hand and know the known dosage and concentration that can selectively inhibit known coral pathogens. Because if something hits the fan in that tank, everything is dying. Like that's a time to where you pull out the fire extinguisher off the wall and you try to use it to save what you have. Now, that's a very, you know, good example of how to do it. Have an idea of what your tank's microbiome is already. So if you've not done it already, send in an aquabiomics test. One of the best times to test is when your tank looks good, because you can see what the good families are and what a more ideal mix is. But if you're actively going through an event to where you're losing everything and you've got to do it, I mean, I suppose you can, but you can also do the tried and true. You take out stuff, you cut off the affected region, you amputate it, you do an iodine dip. and you identify, like, it's going to be a chemical thing that's causing that, or a fish picking at stuff, right? Abiotic or biotic stress. So identifying the root cause of that, what that is. Maybe you've got trace contamination. Maybe you had a huge phosphate swing. Maybe you had like a fish die and you had like a bunch of waste accumulate. So fixing whatever that is and then trying to stop it in its tracks by isolating the healthy coral from the diseased portion of it. That's another alternative.
I just want to mention a comment. Amanda Meckley said, we found some fungi pathogens in torches and worms. So much we still don't know. Yes, and Chris from ACI mentions that the known dosage, is talking about oxalic acid, is coming out in Coral Magazine, the next issue. So there's going to be some guidance with some research behind it for, yes, I know, for that stuff.
I know Chris. I talked to Chris on the phone today, actually. I know Chris and Amanda have quite a bit of data behind it. So that would be a good starting point for something that has data and anecdote and is a much better place than listening to the random guy that owns a fish store saying you should throw 4 antibiotics at a random dosage and contact time in your tank.
Yeah, so I was talking to Chris too right before the show, and they mentioned, I think Amanda said, yeah, that I'm going to be in that article as well, because I did a pre-post aquabiomics using oxalic acid, and I did this a few years ago in my tank. And so I was getting some RTN and STN events, and I got the protocol from Chris, and I did it, and it just completely turned it around. But, you know, at that time it was experimental, so there's a lot of research still being done, and you know, I had a lot of people reaching out to me asking me for it, and I was like, just hang in there. There's a protocol coming. This is all experimental. But yeah, you know, and listen, it is like a last resort. Because you just don't want to, as soon as you, it could be a lot of other things that are going on in the tank that can be resolved by adjusting trace elements, or by, you know, could be very low phosphates. It could be a whole number of things that are causing these events, these diseases to pop up. So just, you know, trying to go the easy route and hitting with the antibiotics is not a good thing. And if you do it once and then it happens again, like a year down the road, you want to do it again, then that's a dangerous thing, because then you potentially are creating resistant strains of pathogenic bacteria, and that's not a good thing.
Yeah, and I think that oxalic acid is a much better option than Cipro. One, it's not as regulated, so you can get it.
Yeah.
And it's also not used in human medicine.
Right.
So if you've got resistant strains in your tank, like, you know, I got a mycobacteria infection. Imagine if you dose Cipro, then you've got antibiotic resistant mycobacteria. That's not good.
Yeah.
And on top of that, Cipro was a newer iteration of the type of chemical structure that oxalic acid is. So it's from a quinolone to a fluoroquinolone. So they've added a fluorine ion, and that allows it to also work on gram positive bacteria. So it's not as selective, and it has more of a profound impact on the microbiome compared to oxalic acid, which is pretty much exclusively gram negative.
So, Selim, the last thing I wanted to ask you about, and you talked about it, you briefly mentioned UV sterilizers before, and you know, we do know that it impacts the microbiome. I mean, I've seen it in my microbiome reports, because I use UV. I've used UV on and off for years, but now I am using it. You know, and I have healthy corals in my system. I use UV. You know, I know other reef keepers that use UV and have successful reef tanks, but we do know that it does impact that profile. There are benefits to using UV in a reef tank. You know, you can it can certainly help in terms of the prevention or elimination of dinoflagellates, and that's a good thing. I guess it can help in terms of some fish diseases. It's not going to be the cure all though, or a way to prevent fish disease from happening in a tank. Why do you not like it? I mean, is it solely because it does eliminate certain good guy bacteria in the microbiome in a reef tank, and over time that could be detrimental?
So, first of all, I think there can be a place for UV, right? I think someone has to ask themselves what they want to accomplish with their tank. If they're more fish heavy and coral are an afterthought, and they just are fine with coral, you know, doing well enough, then I think it makes sense if you invested $10,000 in fish to have a UV sterilizer. They are, you know, imperative to with fish health in a lot of ways, because, you know, even with the best quarantine, you can sometimes still have something slip through. All it takes is a drop of water from somewhere else. So that's one thing. Second, though, if you have decided that you would like to chase the dragon in terms of coral, I think that the microbiome is the Wild West of that. That's the new frontier. We've got relative mastery, I would certainly say, over the inorganic chemistry side with ICP, you know, testing and trace element supplementation now. So if we're looking at a perspective of what corals need, I think it's a difference in different like levels of thriving, right? So you might have very healthy corals. I have no doubt about it. I'm sure you're getting good growth, good coloration, good polyp extension. But could it be even better? And I think that's something we always ask ourselves, and I think it could be. I think that many of the families that UV is known to eliminate, so Pelagiobacteriaceae, Oceosporiliae, Pelagiobacteriaceae is picoplankton that is a constant nutritional source for coral. Oceosporiliae, some of those are the really good guys that help regulate the microbiome. On top of this, both families are known to metabolize DMSP, one of those sulfur-based envochemicals that attracts pathogens. So I think what having these core, I think you can have a reef tank be happy and relatively healthy without these core families, but I think what they allow you to have is wiggle room. If you've got constant nutrition from a bacterial food source and you have two bacterial families that help regulate the microbiome and that are proven to through copious papers, then you can have that swing and have an accident while you're on vacation and you're less likely to have something really bad happen. So I think it gives you a buffer as well.
Interesting. Matt Shreve, thank you so much for the super chat. So much knowledge in one stream. Keep up the great work. Salem.
Thank you.
Interesting comment about talking about UV. Vinny Garneau of Vince Fins have used ozone for more than 20 years. I wonder if this kills off some bad bacteria. Does ozone impact the microbiome at all?
So Aquabiomics X Reef Builders, you know, collaborative effort for community science. Project one, carbon dosing. Project two, ozone. So,
and project three, aqua-eating flatworm?
Probably, yeah. One thing I will say before I go here, I did not touch on earlier when I was talking about the concoction, is Alan has this new, basically like a concentrate of it. So it's like a goop, you know, and he has sent me that goop. It arrived today. And I'm someone who is relatively open-minded. I'm going to be completely transparent and say I could be wrong about everything I said. There are my opinions that I have based on the knowledge that I have acquired up until this point. But plain and simple, we don't have data to quantify these things. So I am going to take samples of it, and I'm going to test it on my tanks and do aquabiomics over a course of time. I sent him a variety of phytoplankton strains, and he's going to test those and see if a similar nutritional thing is achieved. And also, I've got access to a gas chromatography mass spectrometer and a liquid chromatography mass spectrometer, which basically are machines that it's very similar to kind of how ICP works, except it's organic chemistry. So I can take these samples and see what organic compounds have been produced. So I'm going to take his goop and put it in there and see if there's any potentially toxic metabolites, known endotoxins produced by bad bacteria. If there's anything that's interesting or good, what carbon sources are at play to get a better idea of what we're adding into our systems if we're using the concoction. So that's the thing I wanted to say is that, you know, I have my doubts, but I'm open to it being something great. And hopefully it is. Hopefully I'm wrong and it is something that's really good. That would be great for everyone. But we're going to test it and look at it.
No, I agree. You know, the more data that we can have in this hobby, the better, because there's a lot of anecdotal, you know, evidence out there. And so, you know, the stuff that Aquabiomics provides in terms of that kind of data and any other stuff, any other testing that we as reef keepers can do. So, I certainly applaud you and we'll be glued to you know your the findings in terms of what you find out with all this research. So Salem, man, listen, I appreciate you taking the time to spend with us tonight and there was a lot of information in this, but I think we all learned something. I know I did, and I appreciate your passion for the hobby, and I'm sure it rubs off and you know, people appreciate it. So thanks, man.
Well, thank you, and I really appreciate you having me on. I've been watching for a long time. I've always liked it, so you know, it was like a dream come true to be on here and actually get to talk. So it's like definitely been a goal for me. It's like, yeah, I want to get on Reef Bum. So thanks for having me on, man.
Well,
it was a great
time. Certainly
have
you back on, Salem. Want to kind of follow up on all these things you're researching and questions that are still hanging out there. So
when I've got the data out, you'll want to have me on. I'll say that.
All right. Can I? Well, Reef Builders will get you first, but then I'll get you after that.
That sounds good. Yeah. Then I'll have it in writing.
Yeah, cool. All right. Well, listen, I want to thank Salem for being on tonight's live stream. I also want to thank the sponsors one more time, Polar Reef. Make sure to check out Polar Reef's new video, YouTube video that drops this Friday after an unexpected aquarium leak in the Polo Lab. Check out what drastic measures the team had to take. As a bonus treat, be on the lookout for a video drop tomorrow highlighting a special guest podcast. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polar Reef for video drop notifications. Champion Lighting and Supply. Besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. And Todd and the Champion Lighting crew will be at Reefapalooza Orlando this weekend, so be sure to stop by the booth and say hello. My third sponsor, GHL. Personally, I'm all in on GHL products. I have a lot of success using their dosers, ProFlux 4 controllers, the Mitra lights, Cage Director, the whole nine yards. They produce high-quality German-engineered products. For more information or to purchase their stuff, you can visit aquariumcomputer.com/USA, and you can also find it on my website, reefbum.com. A big thank you to Paul, who is the moderator as well as the president of the Boston Reefer Society. Please join and support your local reefing clubs. They are so important to this hobby. Finally, I want to let you all know that all episodes of Rapping with Reef Bum are available as podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Amazon. My next Rapping with Reef Bum live stream will be on Tuesday, April 23rd, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. My guests will be Eli and Andy. So we'll be talking more about, I'm sure, bacteria there, Salem.
Yep. Sounds like
it. you can check out the full upcoming schedule of guests on reefbum.com under the YouTube section. Until then, be safe and be well. Later.